The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It is the detective's dictum. To catch a thief, think like a thief. To prevent a crime, you have to case a joint like a potential infiltrator. Look for the weak spots, the air shafts, sewer tunnels, exposed walls and rooftops that become scenes of crimes and getaways. Which means you have to think like an architect. That is one tactic, anyway, played out with a mad scientist delight by Jeff Mano in A Burglar's Guide to the City. The book gives readers a pair of X-ray glasses, presenting the built environment through the eyes of former bank robbers, cops, FBI agents, and panic room builders, among others, along with the mechanics of some historic heists. And Jeff Mano, who is not a burglar, but author of Building Blog and the book, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
I think this is the first book that I've ever seen categorized as architecture slash true crime.
I was secretly delighted to see that, actually. It's not a combination you run into very often.
But you do make a point that burglary requires architecture. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's an interesting crime because you can't have burglary without buildings. So it literally requires an individual to be inside a structure of some kind in order to be considered a burglar. And so burglary is legally defined by its relationship to architecture, but also has a kind of technical relationship to the built environment that I found really fascinating, which is that burglars look at buildings in ways that homeowners or architects themselves tend not to. So they'll see a front door, but that will be the very thing that they'll avoid. They'll see a wall, but instead of assuming that it's something they're meant to walk along, they'll try to get through it. They'll even find a way to cut down through a roof or other ways to access or engage with architecture that is much more aggressive and much more hands-on, but is a kind of an alternative way of dealing with buildings. And so all of that really made me want to look at architecture and cities from the point of view of a burglar to understand what they see and how it reveals something different. You know, where you and I might see the aesthetics of a building or the historic references of the ornaments on the outside of a building, a burglar will see a convenient handhold or a place to hide. And that was a point of view I really wanted to explore more with the book.
We meet a lot of successful and not so successful criminals in your book. One of them, the ingenious George Leonidas Leslie. He studied architecture in Cincinnati before coming to New York in 1869. Could have made it probably as a legitimate architect, but became a master thief. Why?
The psychological reasons are, you could debate those, I think, endlessly. What's interesting, I think, is how he realized that the skills he had as an architect, that he was able to understand how a building could be constructed, how its internal systems would work, was also perfect knowledge for a burglar, that if he could build something, he could also break into something. There's something really interesting about that, I think, because, we tend to trust architects. You know, why would you mistrust somebody who comes along and says that they have been working on a building or they're designing a house and they would love to see the blueprints of your house? They're trying to understand maybe how to put a wraparound porch or how the master bedroom could fit above the garage. But what Leslie was doing when he asked those same kinds of questions in the 19th century cornering bankers at cocktail parties and asking to see their blueprints was that he was a kind of amassing spatial information about the city so that he could case buildings better. He would draw his own plans of the buildings that he would walk through. He would, as I mentioned, take a look at other people's blueprints. And eventually, he really kind of had architectural knowledge of the East Coast that was so extensive that at one point, his bank crew was so good, they were behind 80% of all the bank crime in the United States, which is almost every crime of breaking and entering from a bank point of view of that era. Which really shows that architectural knowledge, when put to the wrong end, can be a really effective tool for criminals.
One of the other things that you write about him is that he would create these elaborate scale models of constructions right down to the furniture.
Yeah, it was really an impressive undertaking, and kind of revealed that, that this was his way of going into architecture. So rather than avoiding an architectural career, he just sort of created his own alternative path. But so, yeah, he worked with a colleague, a really interesting woman in her own right, who was named Mar Mandelbaum. She was a fence who would sell his stolen goods. But she had a series of warehouses over in Brooklyn, and this is where he would build extremely elaborate three-dimensional models of the banks that they would attack. And so, as you mentioned, it would be down all the way to the furniture. So if there was a table or a chair that they had to avoid and not bump into in the middle of the night, he would actually have his cohorts train in the darkness with a stopwatch until they were so good that they weren't bumping into anything. And it was only after they had mastered the art of the heist on these kind of surrogate interiors that they would then head out and actually hit the bank that they were actually targeting.
So in order to prevent thievery, you have to know how a thief would plan things out, like this former burglar from Toronto that you met and spoke with. What was his trick? How did he infiltrate buildings?
Yeah, he was a really interesting individual and certainly the most creative burglar or former burglar that I spoke to for the book. But he also revealed that we are surrounded by vulnerabilities that we don't see, and sometimes because those vulnerabilities are invisible. So what I mean by that was that he realized that he could actually use the city's fire code as a targeting mechanism. So he was so creative in his approach that he had memorized how fire code shaped buildings, how it regulated the design of interiors, how it tried to keep people safe by putting apartment doors a certain fixed distance from emergency escape stairs inside of a building, to even what floors have alarmed doors for those same emergency escapes. And he could have a pretty accurate understanding of how a building was designed and how many people lived in it and even how big the apartments were, all without setting foot inside the building. And so this notion that the very code of the city can be turned into a burglar's tool was really, sort of flipped my understanding of the city on its head, and also revealed that something that is meant to protect us, something that is meant to keep us safe in a fire so that we can escape and get outside to the street without being caught up in an inferno, can, if used by the wrong people, be turned into something much more sinister as a way in. So similar to George Leonidas Leslie, who realized that his knowledge of how banks are constructed could be used to become an ideal bank robber, this individual in Toronto really kind of revealed that everything about a city, if looked at from the wrong, illicit, or devious angle, can be turned into something that we need protection from.
So now he's working in home security. But yeah. You run down through a number of almost tragicomic would-be burglars getting trapped in air shafts or pet doors or between sheets of drywall. But one called the Roofman was much more adept. What was the key to his success?
Yeah, Roofman was another really interesting and creative individual whose modus operandi was that he would break into chain stores and fast food restaurants. And he had realized that in the repetitive floor plans of things like McDonald's or Toys R Us, and in the regulated schedule of employee events where you would open the register at a certain time of day or count the cash at the end of the day, these all happened at very specific times and in floor plans that could be memorized and would be repeated throughout the country. And so effectively, you know, I compare it to Groundhog Day. He could break into one McDonald's, and if he did that, it was the same as breaking into any other McDonald's, and he would do it at the same time of day to the same kinds of franchised businesses. And eventually, you know, his moniker Roofman came because he had not yet been arrested at the time, but he would break in through the roof. He would cut a hole down through the ceiling, drop down into the kitchen in more or less the same place, and then go about his robbery. But so it's really interesting that, you know, he found a flaw in repetition, that he was able to point out that if all of your floor plans are the same, the vulnerabilities will be the same. And in fact, the Toronto burglar pointed out something very similar, which was that when you go to a new development suburb where the houses are built to a similar floor plan, except for maybe they're mirrored or maybe they have a bonus room above the garage or that kind of thing, if you know how to break into one house, you basically know how to break into every house in the neighborhood. And so when you think about it from that point of view, you begin to realize that actually there is a way of looking at architecture that is pretty unique to the burglar that can reveal some of some aspects of the ways that we can learn to protect ourselves or the vulnerabilities that we are surrounded by that we might not have noticed before.
My guest is Jeff Maino. He writes about architecture and design, and he travels into the underworld for perspective on how criminals and those tasked with stopping them look at our built environment. His research included learning to pick locks, riding along with an LAPD helicopter, and getting schooled in the art of the getaway from a former bank robber. The book is called The Burglar's Guide to the City. Well, Jeff, as I mentioned, not only burglars finding ways into buildings, but law enforcement. the FBI TACOPS team especially, they're sort of experts at getting into buildings. What are some of their tactics?
That was the funny part of the research, was the realization that a lot of these skills are repeated on the law enforcement side. And so breaking and entering becomes something that is not just limited to burglars, but is actually something that the police, the FBI, ATF, and even fire crews do. But so in terms of the FBI, what you mentioned, there's a really fascinating program that was actually referred to as Operation Stagehand. And so that sounds very pompous and kind of theatrical, but that's actually what it was. It's part of the FBI where you will have elaborate props to hide the fact that you're actually breaking into a mob warehouse to install a microphone. There's actually things that sound like something straight out of a Monty Python sketch. There's a fake umbrellas where when you open the umbrella, it actually looks as if a piece of shrubbery has appeared. And so you can hide behind the bush and use that to give cover to a breaking and entering operation. Or there'll be elaborate costumes so that you look like you work for the gas company or the cable company, and that you'll pop open a manhole so that it looks as if you're, you know, working with infrastructure, but you're actually tapping into a phone line. And so those kinds of things are both theatrical and interesting, but they extend all the way to the kinds of tools that the FBI will use to get into a building. And so, one of the things that interests me there was that I had thought that I would find amongst lockpickers a kind of insight into how one might enter a building without using keys. But in reality, the people who are truly good at that are law enforcement teams, you know, who are need to get into a building as fast as possible because they know there is a suspect. They knew they need to capture the suspect before they can flush the evidence or fire back or that kind of thing. And so they've developed a whole series of specialty tools that, if they were to fall into the hands of burglars, would effectively eliminate any sense of security you might have. And so the existence of those tools is something that I really focus on in with one of the chapters of the book. And I found one of the most fascinating parts of the research process.
So that's one of the quick ways to combat crime, but there's also a kind of long game for criminals and for law enforcement, almost like a sting or a con in some cases, like in Britain, the capture houses. So what's going on there?
The capture houses are really fascinating. Capture houses are fake apartments run by the police to capture burglars. And so they're actually fully furnished. They even have everyday possessions scattered around to look as if they're a real apartment. But what the police have done is that they will deliberately engineer it so that it corresponds to a known burglar's method of attack. So they'll put a laptop out on the kitchen table and make it look as if the owner's just stepped out for dinner. But they'll also leave a window open so that it's just cracked maybe an inch or two, but just enough to tempt somebody to crawl up and open that window and slip inside. But then they've covered everything, though, with a UV visible tagant, so a spray or a liquid that they'll put on door handles or on the laptop, so that when they then shine a light on anyone who has touched those things, they'll find that they're covered in this glowing liquid. And then, of course, they have surveillance cameras throughout the apartment. But so capture houses are interesting because on one level, they are engineered towards one specific person. You know, if you have one burglar active in a neighborhood or a city, they can be single-handedly responsible for the crime statistics going through the roof. So you try to master exactly what that burglar is hitting, and then you construct exactly what they're looking for. It's almost like a hunting expedition. And then you just simply wait for them to pounce. And so, you know, capture houses have been hit literally within 24 hours of being constructed. Other times it's been more than a year and no one has hit it yet. But so it's a really interesting example of how police are using architecture and design to capture burglars with the same level of innovation that you might have assumed only existed with people like George Leonidas Leslie. So it really is kind of an arms race or like a design war that goes off back and forth between law enforcement and the criminals they're trying to track.
So you show us this solid, orderly metropolis and underneath this, or a parallel, a hidden one. Is that the way you find yourself looking at things now? I mean, do you walk into a bank and start looking at where the cameras are and thinking, could I rob this joint?
Well, I mean, absolutely. Those are details I notice. You know, I notice it when I visit the homes of friends or family. It's the kind of thing I notice when I walk down the street. It's definitely something that I see when I go into an art museum now or am at the bank to deposit a check or that kind of thing. But it's exciting. I mean, I think that the goal there is not to become a burglar or to actually plot a future crime. I think the notion is that suddenly now the city reveals itself as a puzzle that you've lived in all along and you've never noticed. And there are these three-dimensional possibilities that exist where, you know, you can connect one building to the next by going through the sewers, or you can connect an entire neighborhood to the next by following an abandoned subway line. And that if you start noticing how things are connected this way in this alternative underground world that you mentioned, I think it's a really exciting, both intellectually and spatially, to realize that, in fact, the world has more possibilities than we think. And we tend to take it for granted that architects built something in a certain way and that we need to follow the hallways they built and use the doors they put there for us. But in fact, cities present infinite possibilities for movement and connection and exploration. And I think that that's another aspect of thinking like a burglar, is the realization that, there's a lot more to do with the world, and the city offers more routes of things to see and do than we tend to assume.
Well, Jeff Mino, thank you for this alternative view.
Yeah, thanks again for having me.
Jeff Mino, he's author of Building Blog and now A Burglar's Guide to the City. You'll find more in the book at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 1965, Toronto had a town hall that was built to last. The ultra-modernist building seemed like a good idea at the time. Too bad so many people hated it. Roman Mars brings us the story.
It's a big, majestic building on Nathan Phillips Square.
And this is my friend Sean Cole in Toronto, Ontario.
New City Hall. It's formed totally of concrete. There are these two towers that sort of curve like hands cupped around a clamshell.
So this was a big deal.
When it opened in 1965.
The first modern concrete civic building for Toronto, inserted very prominently into the Victorian fabric.
Masha Kelmans used to work in the city planning office in the East Tower on floor 19. She's an architect.
The building really explored and exploited the possibilities of concrete.
Everything was about concrete in Toronto back then.
The play of opacity versus transparency. And
everything.
So the furniture really picked up on that.
Yes, even the office furniture inside City Hall was made, in part, of concrete. But let's back up.
In the 50s, Toronto decided that it needed a new City Hall. So there was an international competition. And in 58... there was a design selected by Finnish architect Villiers Revel.
But he wasn't satisfied with simply designing one of the most prominent buildings the city had ever seen. No.
Revel proposed that he was also going to design the furniture.
He wanted to design the furniture. He had a vision, but it wasn't to be.
The decision that City Hall made was to commission the furniture through a second competition. So Revel was very disappointed. It was very dramatic. He called it the biggest disappointment of his life, and he subsequently passed away.
City Hall felt bad and wanted to pick a furniture design that Revel would have approved of. They gave the commission to a company called Knoll International.
And it was the only design that used concrete?
Correct.
Desks, cabinets, coffee tables, they were wooden, but they had curved concrete legs, and they were really expensive.
And there was immediate public outcry about this furniture.
Particularly from the people who were actually using it.
There were complaints that the desks were wobbly and that when secretaries typed on them, they weren't sturdy.
But the legs are concrete. How could it not be sturdy?
It's hard to imagine, yeah.
Toronto Star, Furniture Rouse on again.
And we have in our research file many articles from that time with all kinds of really interesting headlines.
Globe and Mail, wobbly desks at City Hall spark new furniture controversy.
You could see right under them to the secretary's knees.
This was the 60s and hemlines were starting to get shorter.
Scandalous. Those were just a couple of the complaints. But decades later, when Masha Kelmans worked at one of those desks, it didn't wobble. When she said,
"It's hard to imagine, yeah?"
It was because some of the complaints make no sense to her. And not to armchair psychoanalyze a city, but maybe, she says, all of this anxiety was really about the building, this modernist monster that was so unlike all of the Victoriana around it. Maybe the furniture was just a handy scapegoat. Plus, furniture is easier to kill.
So of course, you know, as City Hall began to update itself, the furniture, since it was not valued, it was lost just simply through replacement. It was actually thrown away.
but not all of it.
It's kind of like a hunt in here, a treasure hunt, looking for them, but they are here.
In the late 80s, the city's director of urban design at the time saw what was happening.
This is a very subtle one.
And put the word out to the rest of City Hall. If you're replacing your concrete furniture, he said, send it up to floor 19. We like it.
Which is why today, whatever does remain is still housed in the urban design offices, which are within the city planning department.
There's a bit of it scattered elsewhere, too. The mayor still sits at a concrete desk. But mostly, floor 19 is the Florida of retired concrete furniture. Furniture that only an architect could love. Though I have to say,
look at this bench.
It really started to grow on me.
So the hope is that its actual value as a rather important piece of, you know, uniquely Canadian furniture design will be recognized, and that it will receive the the restoration and the protection that it deserves.
Do you miss it?
No.
And that story came to us from Roman Mars and producer Sean Cole in the podcast 99% Invisible. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. First, we shape our dwellings, Winston Churchill famously said, and then our dwellings shape us. Think of the particular serenity of sitting on a porch overlooking a lake, the awe of looking up at towers on a Manhattan street, the sinking feeling of pulling into a strip mall. A growing body of research shows that humans respond to the built environment on measurable cognitive and physiological levels. The upshot? Boring architecture takes a toll on our psyches and our bodies, leaving people feeling less social, stressed out, and possibly even more prone to attention deficit disorders. That's a problem in many places where big, boxy retail chains, drugstores, and bank branches are just about the only thing being built. Jacoba Urist is an art and culture journalist, and she surveyed a number of studies for her article, The Psychological Cost of Boring Buildings, for New York Magazine. And Jacoba, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
So architects and planners have long argued for more interesting cityscapes. Now cognitive scientists, too. Is there a general conclusion about the studies that you surveyed?
Yeah, you know, what I thought was so exciting about all of these studies, and they come from sort of different angles, looking at the problem of architecture and building interesting, well-thought and well-planned cities. But what's so interesting is what I call visual buzz. They all sort of generally agree that human beings benefit and thrive in environments with some visual buzz. So that's kind of the takeaway, I think, from all of the studies. We don't, as humans, tend to do well from an emotional, psychologically, and pro-social point of view when we're bored, when we're surrounded by, I'm from New York City, and we often lament that it's Chase Bank after Starbucks after Chase Bank, and the blocks all start to look very boxy and boring, even in a city as exciting as New York. So I think... yes, all of the studies taken together point to the argument that human beings psychologically and emotionally benefit from variety in their built environment.
So if they find buildings boring or untextured, I think the word is that you used in the article for planners, I understand that. But there's this paradox, I thought, that boring buildings actually stress people out.
Yeah. So there was a scientist, Colin Ellard, who I really loved his book. He's a neuroscientist. He wrote a book called Places of the Heart, The Psychogeography of Everyday Life. And he partnered with the Guggenheim Museum in Lower Manhattan about 5 years ago. And he became really interested in this building on the Lower East Side on East Houston, a big Whole Foods building. This complex, it's sort of a Whole Foods on the bottom, but then there are all of these apartments on top. And it it was plopped onto the street, if you know Lower Manhattan, in an area that's what I call notoriously textured. It had a lot of little sort of knish shops on that block. That area has a lot going on. And he looked at this building that was plopped there, and he wanted to sort of measure what happens to people when they're walking by this building. And so he put these bracelets on people to measure their physical excitement and to also have them to write down words that they associated as they were walking by this monolithic Whole Foods. And so he had also a test site where he then after that took them to another block very close by in the same neighborhood that didn't have this huge boxy type complex plop down. And yeah, he saw that actually when people walked by the Whole Foods, as opposed to the block that was sort of messy, with a lot of open windows and restaurants, that they actually recorded words like bland, monotonous, and passionless. And then also their skin conductance, so their actual electrodermal response on these little bracelets, sensors that they wore, actually reached a low, low point in front of this Whole Foods. So sort of taken together, he looked at that and said, gosh, our bodies and our minds do actually respond negatively. It goes meh. Our minds and our bodies go kind of blah or meh when we're around these boring blocks.
And corresponding research found that even small doses of boredom actually generate stress.
Yeah. I found that really interesting because that was a separate study done actually by psychologists. And when they showed people videos, they actually found that the boring videos actually increased things like heart rate and cortisol levels more than sadness. So I found that really surprising that these small jolts of boredom could actually affect your body in ways that was even sort of worse than jolts of sadness.
And to go even further, a possibility of links to attention deficit disorders. And we should know, you know, they are most often biological factors, but there's actually a connection between ADD, ADHD, and bland surroundings.
Yeah, the most powerful study that I found was actually about children, and that physicians linked environmental deprivation. So that means homes without toys or other stimuli. I mean, I think we all think about children's rooms, and when you're designing a nursery and you think of all of the color and the art and the books and the stuffed animals, and that actually homes without all of this kind of stimulus, whether in their room or in the home more generally, was actually a significant predictor of symptoms of ADHD. And so I think that's a powerful study, you know, when you think about design and the idea that mind-numbing places, when it comes either to where we work or live, can really have an effect. And of course, you know, the prevalence of adults with ADHD is rising, and there have been cases where doctors talk about people who change their environment to alleviate some of the symptoms or quote-unquote treat their ADHD, so that if you have a desk job that you find particularly mind-numbing and boring and you have ADHD, one doctor talks about how his patient switched his work environment to one that had him constantly on the road, traveling, seeing different parts of the country or traveling places, different parts of the city, and that actually, quote-unquote, as a doctor calls it, treated his ADHD from changing his work day to something that had a lot of variety, a lot of visual buzz, as it were.
So many people complain about the economic downsides of big box stores. Well, we're talking about the aesthetic ones. Jacoba Urist is with us. She's an art and culture journalist who also focuses on science. And she's speaking with us about an article she wrote for New York Magazine called "The Psychological Cost of Boring Buildings." I'm thinking about, you know, that description of a child's room with paintings and toys all over the place. A lot of people would find that messy. And I'm sort of imagining designers, you know, putting things neatly into little boxes.
Right.
So why do people respond to that mess?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. I'm a parent, and so I can definitely relate to the desire to have, you know, a clean, orderly environment and not a jumble of toys everywhere. But I think one of the things to keep in mind is that there have also been studies that human beings respond well to what they call awe, the scientists that I interviewed and looked at their work. So sort of jaw-dropping moments or things that shake us out of our kind of lull of status quo going about our business but give us this quote-unquote visual buzz, that is something that human beings respond to. And one thing could be, you know, we evolved, as one researcher explained, in a very dense, visually interesting, messy environment. Obviously, as primates and early humans, we didn't have these neat, you know, container store organizational systems, nor did we have subdivisions and these planned communities. So we did evolve in these highly complex, visually dense environments. And so, you know, that could be part of sort of when we think about who we are as humans and what we intrinsically or intuitively connect with.
Yeah, but at the same time, I feel, you know, I used to live in the city, but when I go there now, I feel just tired and overstimulated. You know,
sure.
I don't want to live on the Las Vegas Strip, certainly, which I suppose has a lot of texture. Is there a happy medium between too much stimulation and too much sort of bland order?
You know, I'm so glad you brought that up. I mean, every researcher that you talk to in this field, and I did obviously for the story that I've, you know, that I've interviewed, they each went out of their way to say, look, I'm not saying that human beings function best in an environment that looks like Times Square or, as you brought up, the Vegas Strip. So there is such a thing, of course, as overstimulation. And when you brought up the ADHD link, what's interesting is that at the same time, the non-biological forms of ADHD may be, for some, because they're in this hyper-saturated environment. There's constant input, right, with a 24-hour news cycle and texts and emails. And one doctor called it, I believe it was a severe case of modern life as opposed to actual sort of biological ADHD. So really the trick is to somehow, as you say, find this happy medium where we're, you know, we're sort of programmed to respond to this visual buzz, but at the same time, we don't want to have this overstimulation as you talk about, which absolutely can lead to perhaps, you know, this exhaustion of modern life and this oversaturation. And I do believe there are many examples, at least in the city that I know the best, which is my own New York City. I think there are plenty of examples of neighborhoods and buildings that very much strike this balance between giving us this visual buzz but not overstimulating.
Well, Jacoba, thank you for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jacoba Urist, an arts and culture journalist. She writes regularly about art for The Atlantic. We found her article, The Psychological Cost of Boring Buildings, at New York Magazine. You'll find a link to read it for yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. Now we're going to step outside of the urban environment and head into the country for a different kind of overstimulation, the sound of bird calls. While some birdsong has an almost lyrical quality, others can sound jarring and not especially melodious. Well, that has less to do with the bird's singing ability than its environment. Michael Stein from BirdNote explains.
To our ears, the song of a marsh wren may not be the most pleasing, but in a dense habitat of cattails, it's remarkably effective. The ratchety, low-pitched, explosive notes, like from a tiny machine gun, carry well through the thick vegetation. Similarly, the wren's next-door neighbor, the common yellowthroat, sings a choppy, repetitive song designed to rattle right through a stand of cattails. Along the edge of the same marsh, an olive-sided flycatcher sings, perched atop a tall tree. Its high-pitched, whistled song carries at least half a mile through the open air. Sharp, clear notes are ideal for a treetop singer.
Different sounds travel better in different environments. High-pitched sounds have shorter wavelengths and are more easily stopped by solid objects, so they're better sung from the treetops. Explosive, low-pitched songs bounce better past solid obstacles, whether tree trunks or dense cattails. And so much depends on the birds getting their message across. What about birds that have neither tall trees nor dense shrubs to sing from, like the Lapland longspur? The longspur often takes flight to sing, casting its gentle song into the air as it glides above the Arctic tundra. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. You hear their voices and you listen to their stories, but you're about to get an inside look at what goes into producing an audio story for public radio. As you can probably guess, there is some research. There are phone calls, emails leading to interviews, recording interviews and cutting up the audio, writing, editing, sound mixing, etc. But every once in a while, a radio journalist runs into a particular radio journalist kind of problem, a little hazard or difficulty to be overcome. Our very dear Sean Hurley brings us the story of just such a hurdle.
This is a story about how I've been trying to keep a certain sound out of my radio stories and not succeeding. And how I've been trying to get a certain sound into my radio stories and also not succeeding. And how I overcame this. It's really a story of triumph. It's also about a new word I coined, bon mal, which I will define thusly. To fail to remove something unwanted from a place while simultaneously failing to add something wanted in the same place and then seeking a remedy by simply allowing the unwanted former and forcing in the unwilling latter regardless of the outcome. This story will be a good example of what a bon mal is. A few years ago, our neighbors traded their chickens in for guinea fowl. These birds were bigger and their eggs smaller than chickens, they told us. The eggs were prized by craftspeople. You could get a dollar an egg, for example, they told us. And because guinea hens are free-ranging, they'd probably come and sit on our porch and lay eggs here and there. But then again, here and there, if we found an egg, really we were just finding a dollar. And another plus was that they eat ticks, and they're like guard dogs as well. So if anything tries to get by the guinea hens, be it a bug or a breeze or a villain, they will sound the alarm. And speaking of the latter, they said, and it should be remembered how helpful this will be in the worst case scenario of villains coming along, these guinea hens are loud. Guinea hens look a bit like moon-colored rugby balls. They have a bit of turkey in their neckiness, a bit of chicken in the frame-skipping madness of their nervous systems, and a bit of pigeon in their smoothie sleekness. I record my radio stories at home in a funny little box in the attic. It's like a square turret that sticks up out of the roof. The door to my office is on the floor. The stairs are a ladder. The top of my head brushes the ceiling of my office. And it is, dimensionally, both the perfect box to store me in and the room version of myself. It's mostly quiet, being up in the box, as I call it, and we live in a quiet part of our quiet state. Sometimes I have to wait for a neighbor to stop mowing his lawn before I can record. Otherwise, my only sound enemies are things like the washing machine downstairs, which I can turn off, but I haven't yet learned how to turn the guinea hens off. So here's me, up in the box, trying to record a recent story on metal detecting.
Testing, 1, 2, 3.
Retired firefighter Mike Cogan from Long Island. Retired firefighter Mike And that's just one example.
Go home.
In fact, over the last year, a lot of my stories have included subtle fragments of guinea hen sound in the background. I try to keep them out, but I can't hear them like I used to. And so with every story now, I have to do a bird pass, where I listen to my recorded narration to see if anything snuck in. And even if I do find something, if I can blend it away into the background noise of whatever story, I will. All the music in this story, by the way, comes from Moon Whale, the debut piano solo album of Canadian composer Kevin Saint-Ours. Kevin is 29 and lives in Quebec. He spent the last 3 years recording his first piano album, and at the moment is trying to figure out how to get people to listen to it.
So what he's saying right now is that he's working mostly by himself. He's using mostly YouTube and SoundCloud for people to hear what he's doing. Each time he has a new piece, he's putting it on the web.
That's Kevin with his girlfriend Sarah translating. Another thing Kevin has been doing, he's been sending public radio reporters links to his music and asking them to make use of it. So I've been trying to do that, trying to fit some of his music into my radio stories. I tried to drop it into my story on the Canterbury Bread Shop and then into my story on metal detecting, but it just didn't sound right. It was too pretty or too staring out the window at the rainy day sounding. And I realized I wasn't going to be able to do it. And because I'd told Kevin that I would, I now had to write him and tell him that I couldn't. I began the email by noting how lovely I found his music and that I wished him well, and that the funny thing was, and I don't know if it was funny or was it ironic, was that I had these weird guinea hens outside my window whose noise I could not keep out of my stories. And so I was sort of double sad that I couldn't keep their sound out while getting his in. Unless, I wrote, there was some kind of kitchen sink, all hands on deck, burst out of the cake, let the walls fall down kind of story that just said yes to everything. Like if there was a thing called a bon mal that just allowed everything to come on in. But there is no such thing as a bon mal, I wrote. I just made it up. I wrote kind regards, Sean Hurley. And I watch my cursor rise and then hover over the send button. Word of mouth? I'm Sean Hurley. Retired firefighter Mike Hogan.
That is all we have time for today, though there is plenty more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. We also invite you to listen to the show on your own time with the Word of Mouth podcast. Just search Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you rate it, that will help other people find it too. We always like to hear from you, and today we invite you to submit questions for author Joe Hill. I'll be talking to him, author of short story collections, the Lock and Key comic book series, and the best-selling novels The Heart-Shaped Box, Nosferatu, and Horns for Writers on a New England Stage in Portsmouth tonight. His new book, The Fireman, comes out tomorrow. It's about a pandemic that causes the infected to burst into flames, and it is spreading like, you guessed it, wildfire across the planet. The novel is set in New Hampshire, though, with plenty of local landmarks to ground us. It's a pretty harrowing look at what happens when fear takes over, turning neighbors, communities, even couples into the us's and the them's. I will be asking him about that book and try to include as many of your questions as I can. What do you want to ask Joe Hill about writing horror and fantasy? About his process, or what it's like to grow up in a family of writers? You can let us know on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio, or you can come in person. More information on tickets at wordofmouthradio.org. I'm Virginia Prescott, expecting a late night, but we'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue and Logan Shannon. Our senior producer is Taylor Quimby.
And our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.